this morning is Halassa against ITT Educational Services. Mr. Matuszewski, you return to argue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Tim Matuszewski on behalf of Appellant Jason Halassa. This is a very straightforward case. The legal issues rely upon one statute, 31 U.S.C. 3730H. This statute was amended in 2009, June of 2009. There was a few decisions by this court that I'm sure the court is well aware of that interpreted a prior version of that statute. The prior version of the statute protected and encouraged employees to come forward and file or investigate and do acts in furtherance of a filing or assisting the government in bringing a False Claims Act action against their employer. The district court below held that a plaintiff to prevail in this case, particularly Jason Halassa, needed to prove, number one, that he engaged in protected conduct. Number two, that not that ITT, Educational Services, Inc., the appellee and defendant below, not that it didn't matter whether they knew that he engaged in a protected conduct. Rather, he specifically held that a non-party to the litigation had to know whether or not he engaged in the protected conduct. And thirdly,
I thought one of the primary things the district court was saying was that Mr. Halassa has not put on the table enough evidence to show that the firing was because of his protected conduct, that he reported what he was finding, let's assume that was all protected, to his direct supervisors, but the decision was made at a higher corporate level, and he hasn't tied together the knowledge inside his facility to the, you know, Vice President Simic and Senior Vice President Esben and so forth. They're a group of people who were responsible for the firing.
He never got to that issue. Third element, he didn't rule on that. He stopped at element two.
What was the evidence on the table that the decision makers knew?
You mean the four people that ITT said these are the guys who made the decision?
Right.
Okay. Let's see. He told ITT executive Julie Shedd. I'm sure she didn't talk to any of the decision makers.
I thought he was really arguing that Ortega must have said something.
No, he reported directly to corporate executive Urschel, who testified on ITT's behalf.
But who's not one of the people who the record indicates was responsible for the firing.
You're right about that. I think that he isn't one of the people that ITT designated as their decision maker for that. I believe, though, that he was a corporate executive.
Well, but is that enough?
So is Julie Shedd. Absolutely.
If the people who did the firing have no idea that he's been complaining about protected conduct, then the firing can't possibly be because of his protected conduct.
The corporation is imputed the knowledge of its agents that act in the course of their employment.
Counsel, that what the corporation knows is irrelevant unless that knowledge caused the discharge. That's the question Judge Wood is asking, is causation. Have you looked at the Supreme Court's opinion in Staub against Proctor Hospital?
You're referring to the case where they reversed the Seventh Circuit?
That's what Staub did. I'm interested in its holding.
Yeah,
Staub is a causation case. It's about how you show causation in an employment discrimination case.
This is different.
No, it's no different.
This is a different statute. This is the False Claims Act.
Need to show causation is no different, counsel.
Well, there is
when you're... That's the problem. So far as I can tell, you have never argued that any particular information caused the discharge.
Absolutely. Urschel testifies...
How are you arguing that, then?
Urschel testifies specifically... on pages as cited in the appellant's brief, he testified on behalf of ITT that one of the contributing factors to Halas's discharge was information that he received from a meeting between Ortega and Jeff Ortega, who was the direct supervisor of Jason Halasa, and Mr. Robinson, who was the dean, who Mr. Halasa peppered his file with at least 12 reprimands for fraudulently changing student grades so they could qualify for financial aid the subsequent semester.
But were those people the individuals at the company who decided to terminate Mr. Halas's employment?
He testified on ITT's behalf at a corporate 30B6 that was one of the reasons ITT terminated him.
Well,
that's ITT testifying.
Do we know? I guess I'm still not satisfied with that answer. I thought that the record showed that the decision to fire Halasa was made by Vice President Simic, Senior Vice President Esvin, Executive Vice President Feichner, and CEO Modani. And if that is what the record shows, that those are the people who decided to fire him, we have to see how the information about the protected activity got to them. Because otherwise, they may have fired him because they didn't like him. I mean, they may have fired him for any number of reasons that might have had nothing to do with the protected conduct, the causation point.
Every complaint, Jeff Ortega... made to every complaint Halasa, my client, made to Jeff Ortega, Ortega had a responsibility and duty to report to Simic.
So do we know that Simic got those reports?
Nor is direct evidence required to prove this case. But no. Directly answering your question, okay, as directly as you want the evidence, no. Okay. Circumstantial evidence, it will suffice in, under prior holdings of this court. Now, in the amendments to the False Claims Act, it specifically was held, or it wasn't held, to the extent that there's any type of ambiguity in the amendment, Representative Berman said on the House of the Floor of Representatives that the amendments are to protect people.
I'm lost. Legislative history unanchored to statutory text is worthless. Statements on the House of the Floor by individual legislators are worthlessness on stilts. What part of the text of the statute is this legislative history disambiguating?
It is disambiguating whether or not the employee has to clearly show to...
Part of the text. What you need to do is point to some text in the statute, identify an ambiguity in that text, and then potentially use legislative history to resolve the ambiguity.
I see no ambiguity in the text.
Oh, well, then you can't use legislative history.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. So, in reporting to corporate ITT executive Julie Shedd, ITT corporate executive Urschel, ITT director of compliance Carpentier, Pepper and Mr. Robinson's file, reporting to ITT executive Bob Menzer and reporting to ITT director of recruitment Hempel, all of whom and all of this conduct was outside the scope of Mr. Halas's employment, Dr. Halas's employment. None of that was required to be done. Internal reporting is now covered under the statute because, as the Fifth Circuit held, although this court is not bound by that decision, the amendment to the False Claims Act now protects attempts to stop False Claims Act violations. So there's no need to infer that the conduct that ITT somehow didn't know that he was reporting or trying to stop False Claims Act violations, because it's the actual act of reporting the False Claims Act violations and trying to stop them and not being submissive or not assisting or allowing them to continue to occur. That's act in efforts to stop a False Claims Act violation. That is what is now protected. The False Claims Act provision at 37308 was amended substantially after a crater in the Dow Jones, a crater in the NASDAQ, the banks almost failing in this country, the education system getting ruined.
Was this argument preserved in the district court?
What portion?
Your statutory argument.
Yes. The complaint has alleged since day one, docket one, paragraph 5, the only allegation made about violation of 37308 was my client's attempts to stop a False Claims Act violation. In the briefs.
But did you make the statutory argument about the standard that applies, which is what I understand your argument to be now?
Well, I did not draft the brief below, and I didn't participate. And I understand your question. And, yes, the argument was made not as succinctly as I'm making it. But, yes, the argument was made. The statute was cited.
But he was the legal standard that flows from the new statutory language argued by you or your predecessor in the district court? Whether there's this heightened standard that applies. That's what the import of the statutory change is, as I understand it.
Yeah.
Was that argument specifically made?
Yes, it was made. Not as succinctly as I'm making. It was made on page 2 of the brief that was filed in response to ITT's.
What specifically was argued?
What specifically was argued was the fact that the statute was changed to protect now efforts to stop False Claims Act violations.
And therefore, when the employee in question is charged with the responsibility of investigating ethics and fraud complaints, that a heightened standard no longer applies? Was that argued?
I think, no, that specifically wasn't argued. However,
because that's the argument that I think flows from the statutory change.
Even if it does apply, let's say this court finds that the statute wasn't changed to encourage whistleblowers to come forward and instead was changed to protect defendants. Assuming arguendo that decision is made, my client did things that were outside the scope of what his job responsibilities were. He didn't have to go peppering people's files. He didn't have to report. He had to report to Jeff Ortega, his supervisor. That's it. He didn't report to just Jeff Ortega. He reported to a laundry list of executives what his concerns were and pointed out, and he was attempting to stop False Claims Act violations. It's an objective analysis. He doesn't have to know about the False Claims Act, so says Fanslow, nor does the employer. Otherwise, only lawyers could bring False Claims Act claims under the retaliation.
The point is that the employer needs to be on notice.
They have to know it. They don't have to be given notice.
No, but they have to be on notice that this is protected activity before they can be charged with responsibility for retaliatory discharge.
They have to know. They don't have to know it's protected activity. They have to know that conduct occurred. It has to be, and the other part of the analysis is it partially objective, partially subjective. They have to know of the conduct. And if a reasonable person would think, and actually as the Seventh Circuit has put it, did my client reasonably believe he was stopping government fraud? And would a reasonable person believe it? If that was the mindset that my client had when he was trying to stop False Claims Act violations, then it's protected activity. And if ITT knew that he was doing what he was complaining, if they heard his complaints, if they knew that he was trying to stop things from happening, then it's protected. It doesn't matter if ITT knew it was protected. It doesn't matter if my client knew it was protected. It doesn't matter if they intended to terminate him because of that, because all it has to be is a factor that they considered in the termination decision. They may have had other factors, but if that was one of them, the jury gets to decide whether or not that was a factor they used in the determination of his termination, or whether it wasn't a factor and they would have fired him anyway. And that, Judge Eastbrook, goes back to what you said earlier about the unemployment discrimination cases. They're all the same, but they're not. This is a different statute. It's not Title VII where you have to show intentional discrimination. This is not a McDonnell-Douglas type case where you go and you have to rebut every reason the other person says, because you got to show the sole reason for the termination was the protected conduct. All you have to show, well, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Your time has expired, counsel. Mr. McRae.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Marcellus McRae. I'm counsel for the appellee, ITT Educational Services, Inc. We contend that the court should affirm the district court's ruling on summary judgment, because that decision was well-reasoned and grounded on multiple separate independent grounds.
So, Mr. McRae, I wonder if we could jump ahead to something we didn't have a chance to discuss before, and that is the question of the costs. And I take it that the Supreme Court's decision seems to put this properly before us, but I'm interested in exploring a little bit the relation between 28 U.S.C. Section 1821 and Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 26B4E, little one, great numbers, because there does seem to be some tension. There's no limitation in 1821B, such as the limitation one sees in 1821A1, except as otherwise provided by law. 1821B just says a witness shall be paid an attendance fee of $40 per day, shall also be paid the attendance fee for the time necessarily occupied in going to and returning from. And that was just one of the elements that you were looking for Mr. Lynch. You wanted deposition preparation, travel to and from, time spent. So that might be more than $40 because of the travel, but it doesn't seem that it would add up to the full amount. So I just wonder how you reconcile these two provisions.
Your Honor, the way that I reconciled it, so to speak, is actually by looking at the basis of the district court's ruling with respect to awarding the fees, which was under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 26.
I understand, 26. And that's where I began. We have
right.
Two rules. We have the statute, 1821, and then we have Civil Procedure Rule 26B4, capital E, little 1.
Yes.
So I'm asking you how those can be blended. Why doesn't the statute take precedence in terms of this type of witness fee over the rule?
Your Honor, the only thing that I can refer to, again, is the Chambers decision, where the court did grapple with the Crawford case, which was obviously focused on the statute.
Well, are you relying on the supersession clause in the Rules Enabling Act? Is there an argument that this subsection, Romanet 1, is a use of the supersession clause, or is there some other kind of argument?
Your Honor, as I said in our briefs, I don't think that we actually dealt with that issue, and if that's a question that the court has, rather than me talk extemporaneously about it, I'm happy to submit supplemental authority on that question. But again, the argument that we had really was that, number one, this issue was waived by Mr. Halassa because he did not brief this issue. And so the court obviously doesn't need to decide this in order to be able to determine that under a clear abuse of discretion standard, there is a statutory basis, as cited in Chambers, for the court's award of the fees that were awarded to Mr. Lynch.
So what I want to just point out is one of the reasons I'm a little bit concerned about Chambers is shortly before Chambers, the Supreme Court, in a case called Crawford Fitting Company, said, quote, a federal court may tax expert witness fees in excess of the $40 per day limit set out in 1821B only when the witness is court-appointed. And the Chambers case cites the committee notes to an earlier version of the rule. And, you know, I recognize certainly that Chambers is out there and it supports you, but if Chambers made a mistake reading Crawford, then there's no reason for us to continue a mistake.
I fully understand Your Honor's point, and suffice it to say that the authority on which we relied was the Chambers decision. And, of course, we think that the district court's decision is fully congruent.
Subcap E post-Crawford or pre-Crawford?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question.
I think it may be part of the 96 amendments, but that may be wrong. I have to go back and check.
And along the lines of being able to affirm the district court again with respect to this issue, I go back to the waiver point as well as the fact that, again, there does appear to be a statutory basis, and under a clear abuse of discretion standard, these fees were obviously reasonable and necessary because we're talking about the expert in this case being able to get paid for both the time preparing for the deposition, traveling, as well as the time attending. Thank you. We were talking about the reasons why the opinion below with respect to the grant of summary judgment should be affirmed. The other point that I wanted to make was that with respect to almost every defense, as we saw in the colloquy a few minutes ago, and every claim, rather, that was being proffered by Mr. Halas's counsel was waived. Indeed, the two prongs on which the district court opinion relied in granting summary judgment focused on two critical elements of this conjunctive test of whether you've met a prima facie case, both the knowledge of the decision-maker prong as well as the other prong, which was the fraud alert or heightened notice standard. With respect to the knowledge prong, we see that at the district court level, Mr. Halasa argued that he could actually establish knowledge of the decision-makers via circumstantial evidence. This court can see in the briefing that, of course, he abandons that argument at this level and instead tries to shift to a different argument, which is an imputed knowledge argument under the one parcel of land case, which is just another species of waiver because under the Alioto decision, obviously you cannot for the first time engage in advocacy with a new theory at this level. It's also inconsistent, the effort to try to urge this imputed knowledge doctrine, because again, below, Mr. Halasa argued that he could defeat summary judgment with circumstantial evidence of knowledge of the decision makers. On that critical element, having compound waiver leaves Mr. Halasa with no proper argument before this court as to that issue. And on that basis alone, because, again, it's a conjunctive test, this court could affirm the district court on that portion, on that basis alone. As to the fraud alert issue, again, we have even a further spectrum of waiver because below, the argument was not a legal argument. The argument was the fraud alert doctrine doesn't even apply to me. That was a factual argument. Again, once we come to the Court of Appeal, Mr. Halasa has abandoned that argument and has instead attempted to argue that somehow he falls within the ambit of the efforts to stop, one or more efforts to stop a violation. Important to note what the district court zeroed in making the decision there and talking about this heightened notice standard, which is that Mr. Halasa was actually alleging below that he was terminated, and I believe if you look at his opposition to summary judgment motion, both on the first page and the first sentence, as well as in his conclusion, he says he was terminated for investigating. And this is obviously the in furtherance prong with respect to trying to be a claimant under the False Claims Act. The effort to investigate, being the gravamen of his complaint there, is obviously different from what he's trying to urge now. Not that it may be of great moment, because he doesn't advance how the fraud alert doctrine or the heightened notice standard wouldn't apply even if we were to accept the argument that he was engaged in one or more efforts to stop a False Claims Act. And indeed, like many of his arguments, they're perfunctory because there's no decision of law supporting them. There's no reasoned analysis, and that's just another form of waiver. And, of course, all of the arguments that were advanced in our brief have not been met because, as the Court is probably aware, there's no reply brief as to this. And so even if we were to just focus on the failure to address the multiple defects in the effort to try to say there's an abrogation of the heightened notice standard, that would be yet another independent basis for this Court to affirm the District Court. We've addressed some issues with respect to costs. I don't know if the Court wants me to talk about deposition exhibits or reporters' fees or the other issues. I'm happy to do so, but of course I'm far more interested in what Your Honors have to say or whether there are further inquiries of me that you would like me to address.
Doesn't look like we have further questions.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. The Court will let you know later whether we need supplemental briefs on the supersession clause and similar matters. The case is under advisement.